Bay versus MCC Acquisition, Lewis A. Abreu, Appellants Counsel, Robert W. Lofton, John T. Walker IV, Appellees Counsel. Parties, please note that Justice Mims will not be participating in this case. Senior Justice Millett will be participating. Mr. Abreu, are you connected and can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Lofton, are you connected and can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Chief Justice Lemons, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Goodwin, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Powell, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, could you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, could you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Chafin, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Millett, could you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, the parties are ready to proceed.
Mr. Abreu, you may start.
Thank you, Justice Lemons, and I appreciate the opportunity, and may it please the court. It's Lewis Abreu here on behalf of Ms. Bay. We do appreciate the opportunity to try and get this one right and on a bigger basis to also add to Virginia case law clarifying the mandatory aspects of the UCC concerning the transfer of stock. The court issued a decision in August of 2019, which was after we had initially briefed the petition for appeal, that that clarified law relating to the transfer of stock in Virginia, and we believe that the Knopp case in very large part is the controlling case. And before I forget, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve at least 3 minutes for rebuttal, maybe a little longer, depending on when I finish. But in the Knopp case, and going to the heart of this case, the court recognized that in 1997, I believe it was, the Virginia legislature adopted a statute, Section 8.8A301, governing the transfer of stock, and it indicated the only ways that stock could be transferred. I'll pause a second on the word only, because I think in Justice McCulloch's opinion, he pointed out that the deletion of the word only subsequent to the initial adoption of the UCC section did not change the intent or the meaning of the statute and the legislature and open up the door for any other ways for the transfer of stock. In our case, there's a lot of issues, questions, inferences that can be asserted or found, but in key aspects of this case, there are no issues we would submit. The parties have agreed that what was at issue was stock. The parties have agreed that the stock existed as of December 1999. I believe it was December 6, 1999, when the transaction closed, and that at no time was the stock delivered to MCC Acquisition, that MCC took no action whatsoever to seek to have the stock transferred into its name or held for its benefit by someone independent of MC Construction. And it wasn't until 2013 that it learned of the stock. We submit that at that point, the statute of limitations had expired for MC Construction to seek to obtain the stock. MCC. MCC has tried to avoid alleging that there was a breach in 1999 because obviously it recognizes the statute of limitations. is an issue. But we do note that in its claim for legal fees, it asserted that there was a breach such that it was entitled to recover. They were astute in trying to assert that that breach only occurred when MC Construction or Ms. Day refused to cooperate with it with MCC to have the stock, or at that point the proceeds from the stock, transferred into the name of MCC. But really, that breach would have existed from day one. I think that the Shipman versus Krupp case, which we have cited in our brief, is very illustrative. It takes you back to law school, basically, in the sense that it discusses duty, breach, cause, and damage as the underlying basis for when a cause of action would arise, and then focusing on the damage, it also indicates that it has to be damage, but it doesn't have to be the majority of the damage or the biggest part of the damage.
May I ask you this question? The question, I think, in the case is who is the rightful owner of the property that's been interpleaded. Am I right? That's the ultimate question?
Yes, sir. And we believe
that... So if that's the ultimate question, and no one's suing your client, alleging duty breach damages, and the only issue on the table is who is the true owner of this stock, why isn't the whole case resolved one way or the other on the question of whether or not the buyer in this deal got equitable ownership of the stock, or whether, as you assert, the stock was actually excluded from the sale? Why isn't that the only issue that needs to be decided?
Because of the Knopp case under the UCC, when you're dealing with stock, there's only certain ways that it can be transferred, and the focus is on the delivery of the stock. I understand that Judge Markow tried to change names and allege that it was a chosen action, but as between the parties, what was agreed to, that it was stock. And it is also agreed to and admitted during arguments that Trigon was the stock that existed in 1997 as a result of a demutualization, and that Trigon stock existed in 1999. It also was admitted that Trigon issued stock and sent it to the members, but to a certain extent, those distinctions aren't really probative, because whether the stock is certificated or uncertificated, Section 8.8A301 deals both with the transfer of certificated and uncertificated stock, and it requires an actual delivery. That never occurred, and there was a confusion by the subsequent change in, WellPoint, when it converted the stock or took action to end the stock ownership. And what we submit may have happened is that at that point, no one claimed the stock, certificated or uncertificated, and that's how it ultimately got to the Commonwealth. But the cause of action or the rights of the parties go back to 1999, not 2002 or at any time subsequent to that. And when the action actually was asserted as to who owned the stock, the first time that MCC asserted its claims was in 2013, and at that time, MC or Day asserted that, one, it was never intended to be transferred, but two, and most importantly, that the statute of limitations had expired on MC Acquisition getting any rights in the stock. Again, there's been some confusion, perhaps, or in intentional recognition, because throughout its briefs, MCC has asserted, its claim to a stock, and asserted that it got equitable title and relies on the Cahill case from 1927, I think, to say that equitable title would be sufficient as between the owner and the buyer. But what the Knopp case made clear is that the statute requires actual delivery. In the Cahill case, there was actual delivery of the stock. So we submit that that's not appropriate. Going back to the Knopp case, two aspects of it, the part that dealt with the deletion of the word only, and the court resoundingly asserted that that word deleted, the deleted word of only, didn't change the meaning or intent of the statute. It changed, it didn't change the fact that the legislature says to create certainty in the markets, to create certainty in transactions, and to allow people to rely that things have been properly done, you got to have delivery of the stock, or you have to have a third party hold the stock for you and in your name. We also note that in this case, the stock, or at this point, the proceeds, the money, is still held in the name of MC Construction by an order signed by MCC. We believe that those are the important aspects. Now, as far as the transfer and the breach, we still assert that there was no intent to transfer the stock, that there is an ambiguity in the record as to what stock records mean, and we submit that if you look at the sentence, it says minute books and then stocks and then stock records. So it, stock records means more than minute books. And we also point out that at the beginning of the case, Judge Marcos indicated that he was going to give the inference that the stock was issued and delivered to MC Construction in 1997, and we submit that those are the key aspects of the case. I'll reserve my additional time for rebuttal.
All right, you have 3 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Good morning, Mr. Chief. May it please the court, my name is Robert Lofton from McGuire Woods on behalf of the appellee MCC Acquisition. The judgment below should be affirmed. There are two issues before the court in this appeal. First is whether the statute of limitations under Code Section 8.01-246 applies to MCC's claim to unclaimed property in an interpleader action. The second is whether the trial court correctly interpreted and applied the 1999 asset purchase agreement in granting MCC's motion for summary judgment. I will address both of those arguments in turn, and then we'll address the inapplicability of Knopp to this case. First, with regard to the statute of limitations under Code Section 8.01-246, the trial court correctly found that it does not apply. Justice Kelsey, as you referenced in your question to Mr. Abreu, the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense to a breach of contract claim. This is an interpleader case for unclaimed property, and MCC has not alleged a breach of contract. Therefore, no statute of limitation applies. Moreover, the argument advanced by Mrs. Day is based on an unsupportable inference that the Trigon stock was certificated and that MC Construction had the certificates but failed to turn them over in 1999. The court considered this theory and did its job in weighing the inferences throughout the summary judgment hearing, but the trial court ultimately determined that the reasonable inference was that the stock was not certificated. Had it been certificated, it would not have been identified by Trigon and its successors as unclaimed property. The title to the uncertificated stock passed to MCC in 1999 under the terms of the asset purchase agreement and assignment. There was no breach of contract by MC Construction, and thus no basis for Mrs. Day to invoke statute of limitations. Additionally, however, in finding that MC Construction had a chosen action in 1999, and that this chosen action transferred to MCC, the trial court was, in fact, addressing the issue of whether MC Construction breached the contract in 1999. Finally, as we outlined in our brief, assuming for the sake of argument that a breach did in fact occur, MCC asserts that any breach occurred in November of 2013 when Mrs. Day asserted her claim to the stock without informing MCC. But even if a breach occurred in November of 2013, MCC learned of the unclaimed property from the Commonwealth in July of 2014 and filed its claim that same month. This was well within any applicable statute of limitations, whether it be Code Section 8.01-246 or Code Section 8.2-275.
Mr. Lawson, this is Justice Millett. Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yes, sir.
Any of your rights in this case come out of that contract, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Whatever rights you have come out of the contract. And what you're asking for, it seems to me to be carving out an exception to the statute of limitations. And I understand that your argument is, at least I believe I understand your argument, that if, in fact, there have been certificates issued by the corporation that were in the possession of, I'm going to call her Mrs. Day just to keep Day and MCC straight, Mrs. Day had those, then she would have had a duty under the contract to turn those over to your client and a statute of limitations would apply. Is that correct?
No, sir. We think ultimately whether the stock was certificated or uncertificated is a red herring, because under the terms of the asset purchase agreement, the parties agreed that, and these were two sophisticated parties, they agreed that MCC was purchasing all of the assets of MC Construction, except for a small subset of excluded assets.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. Let me interrupt you for a little bit then. But so what you're saying is they had a duty to turn over all the other items that were listed in the contract, all the personal property, all the other assets. But this one asset, they had no duty to do anything at all. It just transferred by operation of law and it became an equitable claim. They had no duty to do anything? Is that your argument?
No, that's not our argument. Our argument is that by virtue of the asset purchase agreement, MCC obtained equitable title to the stock, regardless of whether it was certificated or uncertificated. And we think that's in accord with how the UCC should be construed under 8.1A-103, as well as the UCC's recognition in 8.1A-302 that parties can vary the terms of the UCC by agreement. And here, the parties clearly said that MCC was purchasing all of the assets of MC Construction, except for a small subset of excluded assets.
I'm not arguing with that part. My question has to go with what the seller had to do. Ordinarily, when a buyer buys something and a seller sells something, the seller has an obligation to transfer, turn over, do whatever has to be done to get the property in the hands of the purchaser. Here, your position is that the seller didn't have to do anything at all. And my question to you, I guess, is this a unique situation so that the statute of limitations would apply only to this kind of unique situation, or is this carving out some sort of an exception so that in contract, whether you call it a breach of contract or not, and I know you didn't call it a breach of contract, but in effect it is an argument that they did not comply with the contract by turning over to you the property.
Justice Millett, if I understand your question correctly, I would say, one, no, I don't think this is a unique situation. I think this is an asset purchase agreement that where the parties were clear as to what was being acquired and what was not being acquired. And in terms of this application of the statute of limitations, I think it has no applicability because here, by virtue of the agreement, at a minimum, equitable title was obtained by MCC. And this court has made clear, and we've cited Cahill, there are a host of other cases where Young in 1990, Barber in 2006, Britt in 2011, you know, that all kind of flow out from Cahill. Cahill, you know, articulates common law principles, but those common law principles continue with the UCC, and the parties could agree to the sale and the transfer of the stock by agreement, and that's what they did here. And this court has consistently made clear that it's going to honor contracts between parties, and so here, you know, MC Construction did in fact sell the stock to MCC, and the question is not the application of the statute of limitations. I think the proper question, which what Judge Marco focused on, is the interpretation of the asset purchase agreement. So did that answer your question, Justice Millett?
It did, yes. You can go on.
Okay. Now, with regard to the construction of the asset purchase agreement, the trial court correctly interpreted the language of that agreement, in particular the phrase stock record in the definition of excluded assets. Because a stock record is something other than the stock itself, the stock was not an excluded asset, but was an asset of MC Construction that was transferred to MCC. The trial court began its analysis, the summary judgment hearing, by recognizing that Mrs. Day admitted both that MC Construction owned the stock at issue in 1999 and the stock was an asset, with a lowercase a, of MC Construction at the time of the asset purchase agreement. As already mentioned, the trial court also recognized that Mrs. Day produced no evidence of whether the stock was certificated or uncertificated, or whether the stock was ever delivered to MC Construction. Because of this, the trial court properly concluded that the most reasonable inference is the stocks were never certificated or delivered.
Let me ask you a question about that, counsel, if I could. You said they produced no evidence, but wasn't this a cross motions for summary judgment?
Yes, sir, it was.
Well, what evidence would be presented in cross motions of summary judgment?
Well, here, the evidence, you know, we propounded discovery to Mrs. Day regarding what records and documents she had concerning the stock. She responded that she had none. And, you know, she admitted that MC Construction had the stock in 1999, had ownership of the stock. And that it was an asset of MC Construction. And so, you know, I think that, coupled with the asset purchase agreement, ultimately resolves the question, because then it's a question, the issue is, you know, as Justice Kelsey asked his question to Mr. Abreu, the issue really turns on whether the stock is an asset or an excluded asset.
But I remember there was a conversation between Judge Marco and counsel, and, counsel for Mrs. Day said that he did believe that there were facts in issue on your argument for summary judgment.
Yes, sir, Justice Millett. Mr. Abreu did make that assertion below, but he didn't, you know, I know of no case that says a bare assertion that there is a genuine, that there's a dispute of material facts suffices to defeat a summary judgment motion. Mr. Abreu offered no evidence. He didn't ask the court for leave to seek further discovery. He just made the bare assertion that there were disputed facts. And looking at the unambiguous language of the asset purchase agreement, the trial court correctly concluded that the stock was an asset with a capital A. As defined in Article 2 of the agreement, asset is, quote, all of the assets of MC Construction, both tangible and intangible, of every kind and nature, wheresoever situate and howsoever held, whether or not of any value for accounting purposes, including fixed assets, contracts, and construction contract receivables, but excluding excluded assets. And importantly, in the very next sentence, the agreement stated, except for excluded assets, the term assets shall include, without limitation, all of the licenses, intellectual property, and other transferable intangible assets of MC Construction. As evidenced by the plain language of the parties, MCC was acquiring all of the tangible and intangible assets of MC Construction, except for those few items defined as excluded assets, which were One, tax records, minute books, and stock records, which is the phrase at issue, cash, a subset of receivables, and some vehicles. And it's our we argued below, and it's our position before the court now, tax records, minute books, and stock records are the internal files and paperwork of MC Construction. But regardless of the definition that you give, the stock was not a stock record, and therefore it was not an excluded asset. And the trial court correctly determined that the stock was an asset, and that MCC obtained equitable title by virtue of the asset purchase agreement. Finally, with regard to NOP, we think it does not apply to the facts of this case. NOP.
Well, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
Our interpleader statute, as well as the federal interpleader statute upon which it was based, says that the race, the property that's interpleaded into the court's jurisdiction is then subject to, quote, claims by others to the same property. So in an interpleader case, you're not making in personam claims against other parties. You're making an in rem claim to ownership of property. So,
yes, sir.
What authority is there for applying statutes of limitations which govern in personam claims inter se between parties to an in rem claim to property in an interpleader context?
Justice Kelsey, I know of no such authority. And
is there any authority going the other way that says, you know what, we probably should do that?
I am not aware of any such authority going either way. I think yes, sir?
So assume, just for the sake of my question, that you do have a statute of limitations problem. Just assume that without conceding it. You could sue them and try to get a specific performance order telling them, just give us the stock. But they don't have the stock. And the stock is in the hands of the unclaimed property bureau people. And you could sue them in theory and say, well, they didn't give it. They breached the contract by not delivering it to us, and now we can't get it anymore. And you wouldn't win that either, because if you were right, you would be able to get the stock out of the interpleader fund. So I'm trying to figure out what logic governs whether or not an in personam statute of limitations defense would apply to an interim claim against interpleader property.
Justice Kelsey, I would say that statute of limitations should not apply in an interpleader case at all, because the question is, who has ownership of the funds? This is unclaimed property, and I don't think the court necessarily has to articulate such a sweeping rule under the facts of this case, but that would apply to all interpleader actions. But here, it is a straightforward interpleader case initiated by the Commonwealth, and I know, to answer your question, I know of no authority that says a statute of limitations applies one way or another to an interpleader case.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Chief Justice Lemons.
As I Louis Abreu again, as I indicated earlier, the key facts in this case were that there was stock, whether certificated or uncertificated, although in giving the inferences most favorable to my client, it would be that it owned the stock, it had the stock, and there was no real evidence submitted at the case or at the hearing on summary judgment. It being stock, the UCC controls how it is to be transferred. The essence is the relinquishment of control by delivery. Now, there can be different aspects of delivery, and I remember the key with the box analogy that was given in the Knox case, in the NOP case. But in this case, there has been no delivery, and Cahill, there's been no delivery. In all aspects of this, something remained to be done for MC to relinquish its control and ownership of the stock. At no time was it ever, at no time within the statute of limitations did MCC initiate any action, and I believe that it is appropriate in an interpleader to assert that their rights expired. Those were interesting questions as to what happens in an interpleader action versus an actual suit, whether breach applies, the pleadings themselves contain a breach of contract claim for the legal fees. That relates back to 1999.
If I follow up that last question with this, your client made a claim on the interpleaded asset as well.
Yes.
What basis do you have to make a claim if it's true that you sold the property? How could you possibly make a claim in an interpleader action saying, give me the property because it's mine, when assuming for the sake of argument, for your purposes, you sold it?
We never intended to sell it, and we believe we never sold it, and we
believe they never asserted a claim within
the time period.
Let's assume you did. Let's assume you actually sold it, let's assume for the sake of argument that you don't think you did, but the law says you did. If that's true, how could you make a claim on the asset? Putting aside the purchaser of the asset making a claim or having some in personam defense asserted against them, how could you possibly make a claim if that one assumption were true?
Judge, I think if you're asking if I sold the car and I delivered a title to the purchaser, and I gave them possession, and then the car was found in a junkyard, and I came in there to assert a claim. Under those circumstances, I would have no claim because I had done everything to divest myself of ownership. I had not done that.
Let me ask that question then. Let's use that very hypothetical. Suppose I sell you a car, and you pay me for it, and I promise you I'll be giving it to you tomorrow, I'll sign some documents tomorrow, and I don't ever do that. And then it ends up in a junkyard years later, and the junkyard owner does an interpleader. Could I possibly go into court and say, I own the asset?
And if the judge says, not based that you can, because they use the car title analogy in that with the father and the son. He never gave the possession, and he never gave the title to the son, if that answers it. And also in Knopp, there were tax returns, a clear manifestation of intent to make a gift, but there was no delivery. In this case, there was no delivery, and we can say we don't deliver, and there is no claim to the property that is possible today because the statute of limitations has elapsed.
All right, your time has expired. Call the next case.